You're listening to Swamp Things Talk, Florida Gators podcast with Orlando Sentinel's Edgar Thompson. Get the latest take on everything Florida with the guy who knows the Gators as well as anyone. And now, on with the show.
And welcome to Swamp Things Podcast. Finally, I'm Brant Parsons with Edgar Thompson. And hate to start it after a loss, hate to start this late, but we're finally getting going on this, Edgar, and we're talking the morning after the Florida LSU game. And the Gators, of course, fall in that game 17-16. And Edgar, this is a team that's been playing on the edge, playing with fire, whatever kind of terminology, cliche you want to use at that. A team that had the rally against Tennessee, which may not be that good of a team. Team that had to rally against Kentucky. In Kentucky, we've seen struggle against Eastern Michigan and Missouri. Needed to hold off Vanderbilt. Did things kind of just catch up with them yesterday against LSU? It seemed to be a charmed existence for the Gators again this year in those close games. But yesterday, they fell short at the Swamp.
Well, you keep doing it, and eventually you're going to get burned. I mean, you talked about the plan for playing with fire thing. Yeah, and first off, glad we're finally getting this going, man, between Irma and all kinds of things. We had to delay this, but looking forward to getting this rolling with you, man. The Gators, they're just, I mean, a team with so little margin for error. You and I have talked. I mean, this is a team that's has a litany of suspensions that obviously they've had to, that's kind of irrelevant now because this is the team they have, but that was a huge blow. You have injuries yesterday, leading receiver Tyree Cleveland, I mean, a big downfield threat, been by far their best receiver. He's out with a high ankle sprain. A week earlier, Luke Del Rio, who I think the Gator coaches are more comfortable with running the offense. I mean, he just runs it with better tempo. He calls out protections better. He can audible. Just things that Franks, who's Felipe Franks in his fourth career start, just isn't really ready to do for whatever reason. I mean, youth is part of it, but he maybe should be a little more advanced at some of these things that kind of showed up late in the game. But yeah, so there's some things working against the Gators, but still, you know, it really was, there have been tempting fate, and it bit them. And incredibly, the thing that cost them the game, the difference, at least on the scoreboard, I mean, Gators did have some chances afterwards, but the thing that cost them ultimately was a missed extra point by maybe their most reliable player just about, Eddie Pinheiro, the kicker, and first missed extra point in 47 attempts. So that was a tough one to swallow for McElwain, as he said.
And, of course, in this game, LSU up 17-3. The Gators' offense comes to life in that third quarter with those two touchdowns. LaMichael Pirine scores both of them. The missed extra point, and we're going to get into, yeah, it was the difference in the score, and obviously if they make that, then you have overtime. But we'll talk about some of the fourth-grade offensive issues, if you will, with the Gators. But did anybody address the missed PAT? I mean, it looked like a bad snap, but they got the hold down. It's so rare when your most reliable guy misses something that seems so routine. And as I watch highlight shows throughout the night and today, they're like, if we're showing you an extra point, you know what happened on it. Just a shocking way in the end to have the Gators lose this game is by a missed PAT by the one guy you think you can count on this team.
Yeah, him and Johnny Townsend. I mean, it's kind of sad when your punter is probably your best player and your place kicker is your second best. And that's overstating it a bit. I mean, they have some talent for sure, but they're devoid in some key areas. But yes, Pinheiro, I mean, I asked Jim McElwain about what happened. He said it was looked like a bad snap. We'll have to watch on a replay. Yeah, it did look like a bad snap. I mean, he just absolutely smother-hooked the thing. It was not even close. So, you know, it's just a tough break, man. I mean, you just can't. You got to execute those things. And it's easy to take that for granted and not be as mentally sharp, maybe. I don't know, as the holder, the snapper, whatever, because it's so routine. But, again, this team cannot take anything for granted. I mean, razor-thin margin for error. And, you know, it's a 17-17 game. And LSU wasn't lighting it up on offense itself. I mean, its quarterback, Danny Etling, was pretty good running the ball, but his passing was, he was pretty terrible throwing the football. And, you know, that could have gone either way. But here's the thing, is Pinero had a chance to redeem himself. And I thought he would. In fact, I was writing that story and the other story that ended up, I submitted into the newspaper, basically the good and the bad scenarios for Eddie Pinero. And he's pacing the sideline. He's going to the kicking net. I'm sure he's down there saying a prayer, you know, hoping it's going to be answered. And he just didn't get the shot. I mean, even if the Gators could have gotten that football to the 40, I mean, this kid has range to kick one from 57 yards. I mean, he does. I mean, he kicked an 81-yarder this past spring, right? He put it on YouTube. Now, there was no pressure. There was no rush, whatever. But the kid from 55, I mean, I'd take a pretty good chance he's going to, you know, 50-50 from 55 for him, if not better. So the Gators didn't even give the guy a chance to be the hero. And if they'd gone to overtime, I mean, you got him, you're going to get 3 points probably every time. So, yeah, it was a tough one for Eddie. I'm sure he's going to carry that one with him for a while.
But as we said, this happened in the third quarter. So there were still chances for him to have redemption, for the offense to have redemption. The defense played well. They gave the offense chances in the fourth quarter. There's a problem with this Gators offense, and we're not breaking any news here. We're not digging up anything. And it's in that passing game. And they were able to run the ball in this game, 194 yards. Malik Davis, 90 yards. As we said, P. Ryan with his two touchdowns, 70 yards. Kadarius Toney had 52 yards. They were able to move the ball on the ground. But in that fourth quarter, when it becomes tighter, when things become more known, you depend more on your quarterback to make plays, especially the way LSU was daring them to pass the ball. And for whatever reason, could not get that job done. I know there are pieces missing, but it was almost a clock management. It looked an issue. It seemed disorganized. It wasn't. You're watching the game and you're wondering why this offense isn't more, at least on the same page in that fourth quarter. And I think that was probably even more frustrating than anything down the stretch, was just the inability to look like they were going to have a chance to put something together, to get it in the field goal range and give Eddie a chance to redeem himself.
Well, there's no question. I mean, first off, you mentioned the defense. The defense was getting torched early on by those jet sweeps of LSU, which is a huge staple of LSU's attack, and really showed the speed, you know, of that team. I mean, LSU has really struggled this year. I mean, losing 37-7 at home to Mississippi State, losing to Troy last week. Now, last week, the team was gutted by injuries. There were some suspensions, things like that. But still, losing to a 3-touchdown underdog at home was, the natives were calling for heads there. I mean, Joe Oliva, the AD, and Ed Orgeron had a tough week, you know, coming into this one. But yeah, the offense or the defense of the Gators was struggling mightily much of the game, and then just locked it down, right? Gave up 36 yards during the fourth quarter to LSU, giving the offense chances. And the offense just couldn't capitalize. And yeah, the running game was terrific, especially during the third quarter. Got him back in the game. But, you know, LSU responds, adjusts, and is going to force Felipe Franks at this point to make something happen. And he just couldn't. I mean, his longest completion yesterday was 18 yards and was probably his best play. It was on 3rd and 13. And at that point, the defense was reeling. The Gators' defense was reeling. It was 10-3, I believe. And it was 7-0, I guess, because that's when the Gators ended up getting a field goal. But it was 7-0, but the defense was wearing down. And LSU was about to get the ball back quickly on a 3-and-out. And he hit a nice pass. They ended up getting a field goal out of it. And you're like, okay, that was encouraging. But that was really the last encouraging thing you saw for a while till the run game got going. But the point is, I mean, Franks has to be able to do more. I mean, he needs to, for one, it seems like he rolls away from his protection, right? I mean, you watched the game. I mean, you were juggling a lot. You were watching a couple of games or more, but he kept rolling away from his protection. And then it's like the play's not being running the way it's supposed to run then. And I don't know that it's easy to go through your progressions and things like that if you're just if you're on the move. I mean, it just doesn't make it as easy. So he has a lot to learn. He has to get more comfortable, get much more command of this offense. But really, the worst example of just kind of where this offense sits right now with Franks at quarterback was the final series. I mean, 4-0-1, they get the ball. Now they're on the 4. They're going to have to go, you know, 60 yards to even get Franks and to get Pinero in field goal range, 55 or whatever. And they just can't do anything. And it's taking forever not to do anything, right? I mean, they're walking up to the line. I mean, there's no tempo. There's no, like, sense of urgency, as Jim McElwain said. And a lot of that falls on Franks. I mean, apparently, according to Pirine, the play calls were coming in slowly. So that's a whole, like, issue there. You know, and maybe that's because Del Rio wasn't on the sideline calling him in. I don't know. I mean, he was doing that before the injury. So there was a lot of things going on at the end that were really ugly and just really cost the Gators. I mean, it was a lot to ask going from the 4 to the end zone, but if you can get from the 4 to the, like I said, even the 40, you at least give Pinero, you know, a puncher's chance to maybe win that football game. Instead, to drive Peter out, you know, on the 25 of the Gators on back-to-back incompletions by Franks when he didn't even really come close to hitting either pass.
And you're right. And that the word I was going to use that stuck me is the same thing that McElwain said. And it didn't seem the sense of urgency was missing. And I don't know if that comes from the rotation that they've had at quarterback and they haven't, but this is the 2-minute offense. This is stuff that they should be working on all the time. You would imagine those are things they do nearly every practice, and for it to be that just disconnected from everything.
Yeah,
that's the word. And just slow and not even slow, methodical, slow and disorganized and slow and just, it was shocking to see, because as you said, if the TV network's using that green line to where they're in field goal range, it's way out there for Eddie. I mean, the green line can go out really far. It's not that they have to get that far to get into his range, and they couldn't even give him a chance. So
no, it was rough to watch, man. And we were all like, "What is going on here?" And here's the thing: is we don't really know what goes on in the building. I mean, we're not allowed to get very close to this program, Brant. You know that. I mean, it's kind of like that at all the big programs anymore. But we don't, I mean, I think that McElwain's relationship with Nussmeier is good. And they go way back to the Michigan State days in early 2000s. They coached on John L. Smith's staff together. And McElwain's a loyal guy. And I don't think that he's, you know, getting down on Nussmeier necessarily. I'm sure he has some questions like everyone, but I don't know that this guy's ready to pull the trigger and take over play calling or fire Nussmeier, all these things that at the end of last season, we were thinking Nussmeier wasn't even going to survive after the end of last season. And instead, he got a 2-year deal with a raise. So it's like, I mean, I don't know, but this is just more ammo for fans, and fans have been wanting Nussmeier's head for a while, and it's more ammo for the McElwain haters, you know, out there, and that's growing in number. I hate to say haters, but skeptics, and it just gives, you know, it's just restless times, you know, with Gator fans, and that just creates that noise in the system, as Ron Zook called it, that no program needs to be dealing with, and they ignore it and everything, but it does put pressure, increasing pressure on already a high-pressure job, and then you get a team in like A&M this week, and A&M's going to score points, and you would think, I mean, that's a pretty explosive team, and you know, it just ratchets it up. You start questioning yourself, and, you know, then the fans start getting restless, and you don't have very good energy in the swamp. I mean, all this stuff snowballs, man. I mean, you know, it was really just a bad look yesterday on many levels.
And I don't like to touch on these things, but you have to talk about it. And my brother went to Florida. I have a lot of friends from high school went to Florida. And as this game ended, you could see just the change in attitude. You said haters, and I don't know if maybe haters, but just that doubt of McElwain instantly comes back. And whenever I do videos each week with Matt Michelle, we talk about the Gators, and I always point out that for everything that people have a problem with Jim McElwain, he's been successful. He's won the East Division twice. You know, he's going into this game, he was 16-3 in SEC regular season games. That's the best 19 game start in SEC history. Tie with Steve Spurrier. He was a pretty good coach. He was 9-1 in one score games. That changes obviously with the loss to LSU, but they win games. But at the same time, you look at this Gator program and you know the talent that is there and the talent that is brought in, and he was supposed to come in and change that offense. It hasn't happened. Games like this, as you said, that fuels that fire, and it gets a fan base that is engaged and quick to turn maybe a little. But I started seeing again those questions about McElwain and the coaching staff and everything, and I don't know if it's fair or not, but
it's pretty fair.
Okay.
I mean, not to call for the guy's job. I mean, I'm not in the business of doing that. I mean, this is a person's livelihood, and they all have families and things. But, yeah, I mean, it's fair criticism at this point. And, yes, Steve Spurrier, they had identical records after 19 games, but I read somewhere Spurrier won like 25 of his next 26. So McElwain's got to win 25 straight now to tie that. That's not happening. They could lose, as we were talking prior, before starting the call. The Gators, I mean, have Texas A&M at home. Not going to be easy. Then they have Georgia that's playing lights out, okay, after a bye week. Then they go to Missouri, go to South Carolina. I mean, Missouri can score points, good quarterback. You never know how the Gators are going to show up. That's always a tough game for them. Could be a night game. It could be cold. I mean, who knows? And then they go to South Carolina, where, you know, you have the wrath of Muschamp awaiting. I mean, you know, he's got a team that can definitely hang a loss on the Gators. I'm not saying the Gators are losing four straight, but they have a tough four games, you know, 4 games in 5 weeks coming up. So this thing could definitely get worse before it gets better.
And we'll talk more probably Texas A&M in the week, because we're going to do this podcast the rest of the season. We'll do it twice a week. But you touched upon it, and before we end this one, we have to look at it. The schedule gets tougher, and this was a team, as I led off the podcast with, struggled to beat Tennessee, struggled to beat Kentucky, you know, had to hold off Vanderbilt. Those are not your 1-2-3 teams in the East. They're going to have to play Georgia, who, as you said, is playing lights out there. They're probably the second best team in the SEC right now. Missouri is going to be tough because it's on the road. South Carolina, you saw yesterday just a little bit more of what Will Muschamp is changing there. This is not going to get easier. There's no break. To get your stride back up, can this offense, not I would say recover, because that would assume that they were somewhere to begin with, but is this offense going to be able to handle this stretch, or could we be looking at, I mean, just something that maybe 4 days ago seemed crazy, but just the wheels falling off this thing?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of crazy to think, but I tell you, last Sunday I just tweeted, or last Saturday evening, actually, after the Eastern Michigan result came in, 24-20 win by Kentucky at home, I was like, man, I mean, who have they beaten? I mean, Tennessee lost 41-0, holds off Vandy that was coming off a loss to Alabama, in which the Commodores gained, had three first downs in the whole game, lost 59-0. So you knew that they were in kind of, you know, just treading water here. But, yeah, they could sink now. And it's it's a tough situation, potentially, and you know, it's the SEC is down, but it's still pretty dang competitive, especially when you have a very average team and an increasingly one-dimensional offense, and that's the issue. And I'm not going to put all this on Felipe Franks. I mean, the kid has some talent for sure. He's got an incredible arm, and he's pretty mobile, but he's just, you know, he's young, and he's clearly not poised back there. His command of the offense is limited at this point. It's why they went to Del Rio a couple of weeks ago. Del Rio is the most limited of the three quarterbacks, probably in terms of like his explosiveness. Malik Zaire, who we haven't even mentioned, is a more athletic guy, but he probably doesn't know this offense at all. I mean, the guy arrived in June. I'm sure he knows it okay, but he limits the offense in another way. You know, I mean, they're going to blow up the offense and try to move to a dual threat quarterback with, you know, the run pass option. I don't think that's this staff hasn't shown that kind of flexibility. And with Treon Harris, who Zaire's better than him, you would think, they couldn't seem to get anything out of his running ability. And Muschamp even was able to do that. But yeah, I mean, it's got to start with Franks improving as a passer. They have to have that threat in the passing game, because otherwise teams are just going to load the box and this team's going to be, you know, in quicksand trying to move the football. And Tyree Cleveland's health is critical here too. He had a high ankle sprain. Those things don't come back that quickly. And if he's not ready by Georgia, ooh, that's going to be tough. I mean, I would guess he's going to be questionable this week at best, but they need to get him on the field by Georgia. And, you know, I'll say one other thing in closing is, where are the tight ends? I mean, a week earlier, Morrell Stevens actually had a couple of big plays against Vanderbilt. Goolsby, I've been thinking, was going to be a good player every season and seems to just not be a factor. Siante Lewis, you know, I mean, he drops a pass here and there, but he's an athlete. I mean, they're not getting these guys involved either. I don't know whether it's because of Franks or because of what the play is, but I'm guessing it's because of Franks. He's probably just not seeing a lot of things out there. And when you have a quarterback who's not seeing the field, who's running away from his protection, who's young, losing confidence as we speak, I mean, it's just not a good situation under center for the Gators. But, I mean, that's been going on for a while now.
And unfortunately, Texas A&M next, and it's not going to get any easier for him. Edgar, this was fun. I'm glad we finally got around to getting to this podcast. It's been the works for a while.
Well, glad to do it, and looking forward to doing more the rest of this season, because it's definitely going to get interesting. I mean, I don't know how entertaining it's going to be from a football viewing perspective, but from just an overall state of the program, what's going on here. I mean, there's going to be a lot of interesting storylines going forward, and I'm hoping the Gators can kind of get it together a little bit, because it's kind of brutal football to watch, and we've been doing a lot of that the last several years.
Yes, it's not pretty. And I don't know if our podcast is pretty, but at least you don't have to see our faces, so that makes it a little less risky for it not being pretty. But we will talk again midweek. We will look ahead to Texas A&M. In the meantime, subscribe to the podcast, share it on social media, and we'll look forward to talking to you again on the Swamp Things podcast, brought to you by OrlandoSentinel.com.
Thank you for listening to Swamp Things Talk, your Florida Gators podcast. For more Gators coverage, visit OrlandoSentinel.com. Subscribe to this podcast, share it on social media, and review it on iTunes. We'll see you next time.